and welcome to the Early Years Web Summit with me, Cathy Brody of CathyBrody.com. Today I'm beyond delighted to be joined by not one but two professors on the Web Summit. We have Professor Chris Pascal, OBE, and Professor Tony Bertram. And anybody that's ever done any research in the UK or have ever done a college course and referenced will be very familiar with the Pascal and Bertram and Bertram and Pascal references. They're absolutely core to the research that we do in the UK. They're also co-founders of the European Early Education Research Association. Tony is a past president and Chris is the current president. Tony also coordinates the European Early Childhood Research Association Journal. In addition, both Chris and Tony are directors of the Centre for Research in Early Childhood, CREC, CREC. They have both advised governments both in the UK and around the world on early childhood issues, so I'm absolutely thrilled to be able to speak to them today on our Early Years Web Summit.
Thank you.
The particular thing I wanted to focus on today, the Web Summit's all about personal, social, emotional development. And the piece of research that you did that really caught my eye was about high achieving white working class boys, which the acronym for that is HAWC, high achieving working class boys, which had some really, really interesting findings. And I thought we could just unpick one or two of those findings and just see where that takes us in our practice. So before we actually start that, could you give me just a brief background of how you came to be researching this particular area, please?
Well, it's an area or a group of children, white working class boys in particular, that Tony and I have been talking about and dialoguing about for a long time for a number of reasons. We know from the big statistical studies that they are probably the group of children who achieve less well as a large group. Yeah. And so a lot of the issues around closing the gap, diminishing the difference, whatever you want to call that, yeah, but basically giving these boys a life opportunities to succeed, these boys are a big part of that community.
Yeah.
The other thing is that we both come, Tony and I, from white working class backgrounds and grew up in poverty ourselves, or what would be perceived as poverty, mm-hmm, with complex families. And so our own autobiography often speaks out in your research interest, doesn't it?
Yes.
And, seeing that in a sense, statistically, how we achieve despite the odds, is something we've often talked about, that concept of resilience and what enabled us to do that. So we had the opportunity to at last kind of focus and do a nice focus piece of research on how these young boys fared from their babyhood through to entry to statutory schooling to Key Stage 1. Yeah. And so that's where the project came about from.
Yeah.
When you look at underachievement, educational underachievement, which of course is different perhaps to underachievement in your life, but it's clearly connected. When you look at underachievement educationally, you see that there are three main factors, and to rank these, the first one is that gets in the way of educational success is poverty. The second one is around, certainly in the early years, is around gendered issues. Mm-hmm. So boys develop later for whatever reason, predictably, and certainly in their language development and so on. And the third aspect is ethnicity. Mm-hmm. And ethnicity is often connected, certainly in England, and I'm not saying the UK, I'm saying England, is related to aspiration and expectation.
Yeah.
And one of the factors that inhibits academic success is the fact that people say to themselves, in our community, in this estate, it's not for us, okay? You just got to get through the educational process and then get a real job and work life. Yeah. So when you look at these factors, the predictive factors for underachievement educationally are, first of all, poverty, Secondly, that you're a boy. Yeah. And the third aspect is that you're white. In those, thinking stereotypically, there are larger states around our country where actually large groups of these boys aren't successful. Mm. That's what the statistics say. But we turn that on its head and say the statistics don't actually identify individual children. And what we're interested in is, what about the boys who, despite those predictive factors, are actually hugely successful? Yeah. And successful at the level that they're in the top 10% nationally in the country.
Yeah.
So that's your high achieving bit. So we focused on high achieving white working class boys to turn the stereotypical labeling aspect into something that was positive. Mm-hmm. What are the factors that enable these kids to fly, hawk, and thrive?
Yes, absolutely. And that's one of the things that I really, that really caught my eye. It's a very positive research, and that it's very optimistic as well, isn't it, in a lot of its findings. And I think the image of a hawk and allowing working class white boys to fly is just amazing. I think that's a lovely image.
Well, for those who are old enough, you can refer it back to Kez, you know, that the story from the North East, that film about the boy who was clearly bright and intelligent, but the school didn't respond to his interest and encourage him to learn.
Yes,
the other positive bit, and I mean, my mindset, and I hope Craig's mindset is an optimistic one in difficult times. You have to be. Is as I say, seeing all children, and particularly this group, as full of potential and competence, and going in knowing that there is bags of potential there that we have to work for and with. And the other thing is, in our own research, the way we do research, which is very practice based, we think the knowledge resides in the communities themselves. It's not a group of experts from the outside who have the answers and then we tell the community what they should do.
So
we wanted the community to develop or support community talking to community. So the idea research-wise was that we'd identify this group of really high achieving, like extraordinary achieving, in the top 10% in the country, and let them tell their own stories. So the idea was that we identified 30 or 40 of these high-flying children, a group from Birmingham, a group from Oxfordshire, so city, these city-states Tony talked about, rural poor in Oxfordshire. We looked at the northeast coastal towns in Scarborough, and we had another group in the steel and shipbuilding area up in the northeast, up in Tyneside and Middlesbrough, around there. And we identified these children and their families, and they gave us the gift of their life, their stories, and we just asked them to tell us how they lived their lives from babyhood through to school age, what daily life was like, what they did, what as parents, what did they do as children, what did they like doing. We talked to their practitioners if they'd been in a setting, not all had, but if they had, we talked to these practitioners about these children. And from those narratives, you'll see on the website that we filmed them, many of them agreed to share their narratives through case studies and through some of them talking to camera. So it's very much giving them the space to tell their own narrative, their own story, to share their knowledge, not for us to construct the knowledge, because we think it's there. And what we did was provide a vehicle for that, so the community could talk to community in a in an empowering and affirmative and respectful kind of way, and a way that said, actually, this is the optimistic thing, you're doing it, many of you are doing this, but here's how we did it, and if we share that, that might help you. And that's true for the practitioners. There's a lot of knowledge there for other parents. And the other powerful thing is we learned a lot about these young boys too.
Yes.
So this was at six, looking back retrospectively, at their life histories up to then. What have been the factors that had influenced them and allowed them to thrive in this way and be so successful at age six? Mm-hmm. And I think we were a little wary at the beginning that what we would find was kind of, to use a stereotype, kind of distressed gentlefolk. So it might be that there were really middle class parents of these kids, you know, who'd separated or something, or something had happened, and that would be one explanation for why these kids, bright kids, were in this group. And then we thought, or maybe it's just about the tiger mother idea, that, you know, there's somebody there who's pushing the kids and pushing them on, you know, and in that kind of aggressive way that's been written about. I have to say that neither of those stereotypes turned out to be the case when we looked at this.
Oh, really?
It was much, much more subtle what was going on.
And that's the interesting finding, actually, that it changed some of this. But there were some two core things right at the beginning that really shocked us and are a big message for us in the field and sector. So the first thing was, when we identified these high-achieving boys, and we did that using the foundation stage profile, so they had to perform in that top 10%. When we talked to the parents about their children, A, they were shocked that they'd been identified, because they're used to being identified because they've got a label. So shocked being identified because something wonderful was going on in their lives. And they had no idea that their child... They knew their child was doing okay at school. But nobody had said to them, are you aware of how extraordinary your child is, this young boy is? He's in the top 10% in the country, not just in the school, in the local authority, but in the whole country. They had no idea. Nobody ever said to them.
Well, I knew he was brighter than his brother, but I didn't realise it was his brother.
Yeah. No. So that's the message. They don't even know. Wow. And the second thing was, when we started to talk to them and say, tell us about life at home, tell us what your day is like, tell us what you do as a parent, they'd say, well, nothing special, we don't do anything particular, we just do, you know, I don't know why you're talking to me, really, I can't really think of anything. And then we say, okay, just tell us about your day, what happens in the morning, and they start to talk, and this wonderful stuff would come out. and nobody had ever said to them, you are a fantastic parent. And in a way, They weren't extraordinary parents. They were excellent parents in extraordinary circumstances.
Right,
So they were doing all the beautiful things that you'd want a parent to do, and we'll come on to what those might be in a minute. And it wasn't, as Tony said, about the tiger pushy, but they were brilliant at parenting.
Yeah.
And some of these families, these boys and their families, were in extremely adverse circumstances. A lot of chaos, a lot of challenges. There was, in the group, there was drugs, criminality.
Yeah. Jeremy Kyle.
You know, mental health problems, the whole realm of it. So it wasn't that they were kind of nice, cosy, tidy, untroubled families. But they were able to do this extraordinary job of parenting really well in these challenging games. And that's the extraordinary thing. Do you see what I'm saying?
The
excellent parenting against very difficult and challenging circumstances and situations.
We have to be careful here, because we're using the word parent, and actually that covers quite a few different kinds of people. But the people taking on a parenting role.
Right. The main carer. Yeah.
So sometimes it would be the grandparents that were the... Sometimes, particularly in the seaside towns, what you'd often find is that the... families had fractured and reformed with other families. And in that reforming, there might be older siblings. Yeah. And one of those older siblings would take notice of this young boy within it. And sometimes it was relationships like that within the family. Mm. Sometimes it was an aunt or an uncle. But there was always somebody who'd become the key player, giving time to the child to talk to them and to be responsive to the things that were in the child. A lot of the stimulation actually started in the child. And what was happening is, it wasn't people were giving the child lots of stimulation themselves, but the child was engaging with this key person who was then responsive and created opportunities and affordances for this child to explore the world in the way that they wanted to.
Which
is a different idea than the kind of the stereotype of the tiger musher mother that's pushing and pushing.
Or putting them in a setting that's going to push and push and push.
Yeah.
It's about being the one thing we found, these were not kind of vulnerable, weak children. They were very strong children. Coming back to social emotional development, something from the early on the parents or main carers identified, something in that young baby, that boy, had been brilliant at enabling somebody in their extended family group, and I use this phrase, to fall in love with them.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, that they had managed somehow, and remember, all babies have this capacity. Yes. It's whether you have somebody in your environment that responds in the way that Tony's just said, to have this form, this special bond. It generally, you know, was the birth parent, but not always. Yeah, but somebody there was there to go to extraordinary lengths for that child, to be with that child and be that child's companion. And it was a two-way street. Then what happened, very interesting, particularly those carers who were in fairly challenging circumstances, the boy became the reason why that carer distanced themselves from the chaos or protected the child.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because the child became the reason why they had to do that.
Yes.
So very complex, these family relationships, which Feinstein's recent work has shown. Yes. It's the relationships within the family that kind of determine. But this child, this young boy, was a strong, powerful pull or push in that thing. He wasn't a child right from babyhood. There was one of the parents on the video, she had very severe mental health, you know, depression, postnatal depression, and it went on. She said she brought this young boy, baby boy, home, and she put it on the kitchen table in a B&B in, you know, wherever, and she said, I have no, what have I done? I cannot feel this. And then she said, the midwife, and this is where key professionals can make a difference, the midwife had come to see her and said, just talk to him. And she said, she gave him that to him. She said, I started talking to him, and she said, we never looked back.
He hooked her out of it.
Yeah. Wow.
When I talked to him, he responded, and then I did that. So these boys were very powerful in kind of inveigling the attention of this significant other.
Yeah.
Just to say that in terms of early years practitioners, because we also talked to them, you know, what had this child done in terms of going to childminders and so on. And so we kind of tracked back through the history and had a conversation with these people if we could find them. The first thing to say is that they all remembered both the boy and the parent or the carer.
Oh, that's interesting.
The relationship, not only with the child, but actually with the family as well.
Yeah.
And not only did they know them, but the carer remembered them as well.
Yes.
They had an established, personalized relationship that was strong. Yeah. Key worker and the parent working together and responding to the child. Mm. And in some instances where the staff had changed, a younger sibling had been taken to the same setting, and the parent had said, you know what, I don't want to leave my kid here because it's changed and it's not like that, and I don't have the same relationship. So in a sense, they were discriminating about what kind of place they wanted to leave their child.
But all the
way through the system, there had been this good relationship where they had both worked together to support the development of the child.
Yes.
Well, that's the first thing to say, really.
So that
look not just for your relationship with the child, but the relationship with the context in which the child is in terms of their family.
It's
back to the focus of this this conversation, which, and we always say this, it's all about relationships.
Yeah.
And relationships are about the social and emotional competence of those involved. And, you know, these young boys had, from the beginning, had that capacity, which was affirmed and developed further by the adults around them responding back to that and developing that. And they were helped by, where there was professional input, by the professionals responding in that kind of way.
Yeah.
It's relational stuff. is really, really, really important. Then we come back to the kinds of stuff that the parent, in inverted commas, yeah, used to do with this young boy. And maybe you want to say a little bit about that.
I think one of the first things to say is that all of these boys experienced quite large amounts of time outdoors. From early days, it wasn't that they were playing football, although some of them were, but it was just that they were out. And actually the parent was pram pushing them out. Sometimes, I mean, I remember one of the parents talking to us about walking down the promenade with the child, and she just used to go, because it actually was therapeutic for her.
To get out the house.
And she said, and as I walked down the promenade, people started, and I was cross and fed up and so on, but then people started smiling at me, and I was cross at them smiling at me. Why are you smiling at me? And then she realised it wasn't that they were smiling at her, they were smiling at the child, because the child was engaging.
Right? Yeah, of course.
But it was outdoor and pushing, and all of them had some experiences, whether they were had a space to play in outdoors, and it could be a public space, it could be just walking along a promenade or a road, whatever. But that was quite an important element terms of they had to have this body space, and they had to be out there and being active.
How interesting. The natural world, the physical world. So the blend of being able to be more physical, because they will definitely have more freedoms when they're outside.
Also
the stimulation of that external world, the natural world, and the people within it.
Yes.
Formed a big part of their daily happenings in virtually every single case of this. So it wasn't that they were cooped up doing bookish stuff.
Yes.
Read to all the time. It was that they, and linked with that, was whether they were indoors or outdoors, was this main carer enjoyed their company, just enjoyed spending time. And they did stuff together, whether that be, building, playing with cars, running about. There was a lot of physical stuff. But it was just spending time, being a companion. And, of course, what went with that was a lot of talk.
Yes.
There's a lot of conversation. So these aren't extraordinary things. We know about these things. But when we think about how do you boost achievement, and if you apply that to practice, what are the big messages? It's about building a strong relationship. Yeah. It's about doing stuff together, being a companion, not an instructor. It's about the other thing was they would generally all talk about, well, we just noticed what he was interested in, and then we'd go with that.
Yeah.
So the boys would express their interest in playing football or building something, or even books. If it was books, one had got fascinated with music.
Wow.
And was what, by the time we talked to him, he was six, he was writing his own songs and performing.
Wow.
Another one was with the football, was being identified for a contract with one of these
at
clubs.
Six.
Mm. So they were going to go on. They'd got kind of power. But that had been noticed by the parent, but the parent had gone with it, not tried to kind of pull them in a way they wanted to be. Home routines were there, but they were flexible, not rigid.
Yeah,
so they did tend to have a kind of bedtime routine and a kind of food routine, but not rigid. And they were quite normal in terms of technology and TV and screens and that kind of stuff. That was kind of not extraordinary at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have to say that the whole movement in early years at the moment towards outdoor play and outdoor activity and learning in the outdoors, I think, is reinforced by the study that we've seen that's something that we should encourage. And as Chris says, it's not about sitting the kid down at a desk and insisting that they colour in templates or whatever. So I would say, encourage your children to learn outside and to be active and participatory. The other thing is that Chris had just touched on is around digital, what we call digital childhoods. I've got six grandchildren, all under the age of six, and they're with their iPads all the time. I'm thinking, what kind of a child? This was true of these kids as well. They all had access. It's modern childhood. You're not going to, but it was managed. So they had
it didn't dominate
what they did, but it was part of their childhood, and I think you've got to accept that. And it was used, and it was, as Chris said, it was controlled. So in relation to digital childhoods, I think you give them the opportunity and you look for discussions that you can have around that and interactions that you can have around that, but you don't let it totally dominate the children's lives.
And actually, what they would say was, well, he does do that, but actually, he'd much prefer to be outside. Prefer to be doing this.
Yes.
And so that's what we did. Because it was always, what did he... They weren't little emperors doing their own, you know. It was just this congruence of intention and day, and just enjoying each. And if that's what he wanted to do, then that's what we did, because that's what we had a good time doing. And it was, as I say, that those being in the company of somebody who is going to be responsive to you. And but the boy himself was a very big part of that. It wasn't the parent kind of, you know, in a very generous way, I'm going to give him this time. The boy made it so enjoyable that they wanted to do that, even though their circumstances made that quite difficult for them. You know, in some cases, they were in low income or poverty families because the mother had said, I have to get away because of my child.
Yes.
They'd taken themselves away. So in a sense, they were even more focused on each other. Now, that's the other issue, why we want to follow this group of extraordinary boys through, because I'm really interested to see what happens as they go through primary school. For these boys, and they were very socially adept, they were very good in their own peer group too.
They
could be really good leaders of that community.
Yeah, they weren't bookish introvert scholars, you know, with a nose stuck in things.
Some of them.
They enjoyed that. But actually, they were socially competent, and they knew how society works, both in terms of your relationships with their adults and the relationship with their peer group. By and large, they're a very popular group amongst their peers.
So in order to progress in that social peer group, which they all of us need to do that, there needs to be a little bit of separation from the parents, because the group becomes more significant and needs to become more important. So this is the kind of thing that's fascinating or interesting us at the moment, is what happens next. So these lovely things have been going on, and there's, you know, we've talked about some of the things we've found out, or they've shared with us. You know, and be generous enough to share that with us.
So there's loads of stuff on our website. There's the other podcasts, and there are worksheets and
practitioners
so on.
Talking and things. But we have no idea what's going to happen with this group next.
Yes.
As they progress through primary school and the peer group becomes more successful and relationships between the carer, the teacher, and the child shifts maybe a little bit, and also fundamentally the relationship between the boy and their main key carer, what happens next? What happens for the, I think the boys will be, the peer group will kind of take over and do it. The parent, who is the protective factor in this from the other stuff, who have they got now? Because often this boy was who they had. Where do they go? And do they go back into the chaos? Do they retain it? So the other thing we developed the concept. So we've got this concept of these academically resilient young boys. We're developing this concept of the of what we're calling parenting resilience. Now, the boys were making the parents good parents. They were a factor, a resilient factor in the parenting.
That
relationship, that daily intimate, wonderful relationship, is changed. Where's the parenting resilience? What happens to the parenting at that stage? How does the school support the parents in that shifting relationship? Because the boys go through adolescence, challenge things a bit more. and I'm positive that some of these boys will, and their parents will navigate that well. Mm-hmm. And want to know how it happens.
Yes.
What to do, because I think that's got all kinds of knowledge there that we could benefit from in terms of pupil premium, the way school, primary schools work with this group. So that's the next bit of the study we'd really like to do, as well as developing these kind of work, this kind of work in other communities. The other thing we've got in each of these communities, these parents we work with that talked early on about developing their capacity, firstly their confidence, their self-knowledge, they were good.
Yes.
They've worked with us on the project, they've developed confidence in that, so confident they can talk to the video, some of them. But they've all said, we'd be really happy to work within the community. So trying to develop parenting capacity for other parents. As resources are diminishing, seeing that there's, in every community, there'll be a group of wonderful parents that might be willing to support other parents.
Yeah.
And so trying to develop that piece of work around how do we better use the capacity, and I don't want to use the word you, but liberate the capacity of the community to support each other. And not in a, I'm the expert, I'm going to tell you how to do it, but just like, this is real life, this is...
These were my struggles.
And this is how to do it, and, you know, I can kind of be a buddy or a friend, and we're exploring new ways of parent support, I suppose. Parent to parent support, or family to family support, that I think is another quite interesting follow-on.
I think that that sort of split, as you say, when boys get that bit older and they need to find their own independence, they need to find who they are, and that naturally will diverge. That's what it's all about. But at no point have you actually said, we need extra resources, we need to buy this. This is all about what's already locked into these parents, to this relationship that's already there. But what we need is that information to come out, isn't it? To share that knowledge within those communities. And I just think it'd be so powerful, rather than having somebody come from somewhere and say, I'm an expert, this is all you need to do, and then your child will be fine. But to actually have somebody say, well, you know what, all these things happened to me, and we managed to get through it okay. And if it was, I popped him in a buggy and took him down the front. That's, you know, how simple is that?
They're not complicated things. Yeah. But it does depend, I'll come back to where we started, it does depend on that, that relationship. And I think for early years, practitioners in the sector, understanding how deeply important those relationships were for those parents, because they needed support too in these situations. They were getting a lot from the child, but where they had access to a good children's centre or a good nursery school or a good early years practitioner, that was another additional bit of magic that came in. And for those who'd managed, they would say they were a lifesaver. They were vital. Yeah. They kind of enabled me to go on. So although there's a lot of capacity in these families and parents, you know, it also affirms that the practitioners too can and many do perform a vital role. If you get that relationship right, that's not judgmental, that's not labelling, that's affirmative, and in the same way as those parents were running alongside their child, being a companion to the child, that the practitioner becomes the companion in a deeply respectful, affirming way to the family, respectful, but also kind of challenging when that needed to go on. That was a vital bit in many of these stories, in these narratives.
I think there've got to be more subtle ways of approaching this than coming up to somebody and saying, we've identified you as part of the troubled families, but don't worry, we've got a program that's going to correct it. As long as you do our step-by-step approach, you know, and if you don't do the step-by-step approach, then actually we've got ways of penalising you, you know, and there's, or even removing your benefits.
It can be punitive if we're not careful and disrespectful. Yeah. And I suppose what we're trying to model and advocate for is a more compassionate, a more respectful, a more companionable approach that appreciates everybody's capacity and believes in that people have that ability, that capacity, with a bit of support, with a bit of support. It's not no resource, but it's about how you use those precious resources.
And looking for things that are participatory, but also recognise that there's power and voice in this, and that you have to distribute some of the power to others and listen to their voices.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that whole idea that you will fit into this perfect mould that I have created for you, that's quite a problem. And I just think it would be fantastic if we could take funding forward, both to follow the boys through, but also to follow the parents. And I can see there'd be massive benefits for community. I can just see that if these boys do go down a different path, then there would be a cost to it. So if we can stop that, and I think we have a moral obligation anyway, you know, without anything else, but to have that funding to follow it through.
What kind of society we want to live in and create, and you know, the ethics and the morals and the of all of that. It is about community and strengthening communities.
Cohesion, social cohesion too,
that working together. And I think even if it is as simple, if there's one sort of top tip I could take away from that, if it is as simple as a practitioner saying to a mum, "You're doing a fantastic job, do you know how well he is doing?" I think that would just be fantastic. And again, we kind of, maybe we just assume that they know, I don't know, but that would be, and I think it, as a parent myself, it would be like, oh yeah,
I used to go with my kids, I used to go to parents' evening, you know, and dread that they were going to say something. And you'd sit there for hours, then you get 5 minutes, and they'd look through the paperwork and tell you, oh, she seems to be doing that. So, and I'd leave, and I think, so what was that? You know, I think you've got to work on the relationship, which is different.
Yeah. But you're right.
Create space to develop that relationship.
Don't assume they know. Assume they know.
Yes, absolutely.
In our experience, we didn't have one of our 40-odd that had ever been told that.
Wow, and yet they were in the top few percent in the country, not just in the setting, in that area, in the country, and nobody had thought, oh.
If you imagine that from a parent, from a child from another community with a different set of relationships, they would be being promoted around everywhere. Those parents would have known, and they would, they had no idea. And that says something about aspiration and expectation, doesn't it?
Yes.
We're saying that they're in the top, this top 10 percentile. That we're not saying that it was in one area. We're saying across the piece.
Wow.
It wasn't that they were brilliant mathematicians or they were brilliant.
It was in that good level of development across all those areas.
So I mean,
so that's potential. You think of that multiplied up across the country. Exactly. You think of that potential.
What a waste
And you know, what fantastic things those young boys, I hope, will achieve, and the ones that come behind them and are there now. What they might achieve if we can get things a bit more supportive for them and affirmative for them, and recognise what they are. That's
absolutely
the bottom line for us.
And I think at this time, as you say, currently in the world, I think that's a very positive message to be putting out there. There are children who are doing, and families who are doing really, really well under very difficult circumstances, but they are still doing really, really well, and that should be celebrated as well. I think that's a great message to put out there. Yeah. Super stuff. Now, I know that you have a big conference coming up in the summer in Bologna. It's the EECERA. I'm not going to get that right. I will try again.
European Educational Research
Association.
European Early Childhood Educational Research Association.
Conference in Bologna. Thank you. And that's Beyond the Crisis. And that, again, is looking at things in a very positive way, looking at research where, similar to your research, where they have found very positive things. And that's from the 29th of August to the 1st of September. And there's a link now on the website. You can just click through to that and go and have a look and see. Amazing
some fantastic speakers.
A thousand researchers from all over the world focused on early years.
That is just going to be incredible. And as you say, that if you're a researcher in early years, that's where you need to be in the summer. It's just going to be incredible. I shall look forward with interest to see what papers come up at that and who... can people still submit papers? Is that still possible?
They can. It's all open till
end of March.
End of March, papers. And after that, you can just come and join in.
How lovely.
You can come as a delegate.
Up to the time of the conference, you can just come as a delegate.
That is amazing. That sounds just an incredible place to be if you're interested in research at all.
Yeah.
Thank you very, very much indeed. Been absolutely amazing to talk to both of you. Thank you so much for organising that between you. I really, really do appreciate that. And there's some really interesting things. I would urge everybody to go and have a look at the Hawk research. I was absolutely thrilled reading through it. All the positive messages that are coming out there, the simple things that people are doing, and it's been excellent discussing it with you. Thank you very much indeed, Professor Tony Bertram, Professor Chris Pascal. Really appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Cathy.
We've enjoyed it. Nice talking to you. Thank you.
You take care.
Good. And thank you very much to our viewers and listeners for joining us on the Early Years Web Summit.
Bye.